Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. Good morning. The Texas Supreme Court continues its tour of the law schools of Texas with two oral arguments today at Texas Southern University Thurgood Marshall School of Law, and we are very pleased to be here. In its early days, the Supreme Court of Texas rode circuit and sat in different parts of the state, but in 1891 that was changed by a constitution and the court sat only in Austin for 106 years. But pursuant to a constitutional amendment in 1997, we were given the authority to sit outside of Austin, and we do that twice a year with trips to different parts of the state. And we've been starting first with the law schools of the state to visit with the next generation of lawyers and with faculties. And we are pleased to be in Houston this week. We have two causes for oral submission today. In the order in which they will be heard, they are Texas Health Enterprises Incorporated doing business as Kern Manor and HEA Management Group Incorporated versus Walter R. Geisler, individually and as legal representative of the estate of Ruth Simmons. This cause is originated in Denton County. And Meritor Automotive Incorporated doing business as Rockwell International Plastic Products versus Ruan Leasing Company from Travis County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioners may reserve a portion of time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these arguments. These arguments are being videotaped by the school and are being recorded here for use by our court. You may purchase an audio tape of either argument for a nominal fee from the clerk of our court in Austin, and the school has a limited number of videotapes which we may purchase by contacting them. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Texas Health Enterprises versus Geisler. We have received a joint motion from the parties to dismiss Geisler's petition, and that has been granted.
It pleases the court. Mr. Kelly Utzinger will represent the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
It pleases the court. My name is Kelly Utzinger. I'm from Amarillo. I represent the petitioners, defendants, Texas Health Enterprises, and HEA Management. This is a health care liability claim that asserts causes of action for wrongful death and survival. It's brought by Ray Geisler, the son of Ruth Simmons. Ray Geisler brings this cause of action in his individual capacity as well as the representative of the estate.
Mr. Utzinger, doesn't your position presume that the purpose of punitive damages is to compensate plaintiffs?
No, Justice O'Neill, it does not, and if I might explain why it doesn't do that. Certainly in any situation where you have punitive damages, a corollary of that is someone's going to get them. There's no question about that. But we believe that the consistent jurisprudence of this state has always been there should be a reasonable relationship between the amount of damages, actual damages that are suffered, and the amount of punitive damages that are awarded. And so consequently, somewhere in that equation, there has to be some consideration of the actual amount of damages that were awarded.
But why does it make a difference as to which one's awarded per individual plaintiff if the purpose of punitive damages is to punish and deter?
Justice O'Neill, several reasons for that. One goes back to the question of the reasonable relationship. The second has to do with when you consider the punitive damages themselves and the punishment aspect of those damages, at what point do you draw the line as to where do you stop punishing? Someone has to make that decision, regardless of who gets the money.
But couldn't they have said it?
I'm sorry.
Couldn't they have said in the statute, couldn't they have articulated that in the statute rather than leave it open as they appear to have?
certainly that could have been legislatively corrected. It was not. And I might remind the court that in the Della Lastra case, it was very apparent from several justices on this court that you did not combine wrongful death and survival damages in order to set that floor.
But in that case, though, at base was the constitutional requirement or prohibition against the award of the punitive damages to the parents in a wrongful death action. So wasn't the court having to reconcile the constitutional requirement with the statutory language?
Justice Hankinson, the way I read that opinion, no. The way that I read the opinion, it appears as if the court held specifically that they were not going to increase that floor by considering the parents' actual damages in it. And it, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
And to take that concept a step further, it didn't make any difference in that case that the parents were the ultimate beneficiaries of the money. It appears, as I interpret the case, that the court specifically held that you cannot combine these two types of damages, regardless, as Justice O'Neill points out, regardless of who gets the money, that becomes irrelevant.
Well, Mr. Etzinger, at bottom, you'd agree that this is a matter of statutory interpretation in this case, interpreting the legislature's language and intent in Section 41.008.
At the time, yes, Your Honor.
In this case, that's what you're asking us to do.
It was 41.007 at the time.
And right now it's 41.0, and we're looking at the other line, at the earlier line.
Right. They added different language, and added the word claimant under 41.008.
Okay. Let's look at that language and tell us specifically what language in the applicable statutory provision you hang your hat on to interpret the statute the way that you would have us do. And that is that we do not look at the total amount of actual damages awarded to determine how the cap should be applied. What language are you looking to?
Well, the first thing I look to is the way this court interpreted 41.007 in Della Lastra that said the word claimant did not appear.
Let's
in the
look
statute.
Back. Let's put that aside for assume that we don't agree with your interpretation of that case, so that we've got to go back to the statute.
That's
and I understand
right.
You're not conceding that point. But go back to the language of the statute and explain to us how looking at the language in the statute would lead to the interpretation that you would have us give it.
Justice Hankinson, as we would interpret it, it appears that under 41.008, I guess now, it talks about how if a party seeks recovery of exemplary damages related to the injury of another person, death of another person, or harm to another person, claimant includes both the other person and the party seeking recovery for exemplary damages. I assume that's the language that you're talking about. You want me to address? Is that correct?
I want you to tell us what language in the statute leads to the interpretation that you would have us give the statute.
There are two things.
Okay.
There are two things. First of all, that statute appears to contemplate a singular award of punitive damages because it puts both of these parties together. Secondly, and perhaps this is the distinction between this case and any other case that the court sees, but in the jury charge in this case, there was an opportunity to give punitive damages to two parties. And that's unquestioned. And they gave $5 million against the two corporate defendants on behalf of the survival claim and zero damages to Mr. Geisler.
I understand. Now we're on to the jury charge. Take me back to the statute, because the statute says that the damages awarded against a defendant may not exceed an amount equal to the greater of four times the amount of actual damages. What in that language would lead us to look at less than the total amount of actual damages awarded in applying the cap? I'm looking at the pure statutory interpretation question, not the way the case was submitted to the jury, not prior case law. I want to go back to the statute. How would you have us interpret that language, and what are you hanging your hat on to give the interpretation that you would give to it?
The statute does not say one way or another. It just simply says damages awarded against the defendant. That's all that it says.
And it also talks about the amount of actual damages. Why shouldn't that be interpreted? Why doesn't that, on its face, say that we look at the total amount of actual damages awarded to determine the exemplary damages to be awarded against a defendant.
Certainly this court could do that. But we would disagree strongly about that.
So the answer to your question then, my question then, is that the language perhaps does not lend itself to that particular interpretation, and you are relying on prior interpretations of this court of that language and the way the case was submitted to the jury.
Is both of those, fair? Yes. That is a fair, okay. That is a fair, okay, comment, Your Honor. And I would also go back to the concept, too, of survival and wrongful death damages.
Okay.
Those are two distinct, separate causes of action, and they've always been. And so what the trial court did was meld those together. But perhaps the more interesting question is this. What happens if Ray Geisler, in the jury charge, is awarded punitive damages himself? Instead of a zero, what if he is awarded punitive damages too? Do you then go back and take a look at both of their damages and add them together so that you have an actual damages group? You multiply that times 4 for the estate, and then you add them both again together and multiply that times 4 for Mr. Geisler.
Well, Mr. Etzinger, what if the charge had been a little bit different in this case, and the question had been asked, and one blank given, the amount of exemplary damages that should be awarded against these defendants, and the $5 million was put in the blank. And then there was a separate question that asked to whom the damages should be awarded. Would you be arguing differently in this case? Would that then mean that we would look at the total amount of actual damages to determine the cap?
I believe that we would if the jury charge was submitted correctly, Your Honor.
If it had been submitted that way, then you'd be you would agree with Ms. Walker's position then?
Yes, and as a matter of fact.
So your view is that this case really turns on what the jury charge was presented?
That's part of what it turns on. Part of it turns on also the absence of any clear definitive language in 41.07 as it was in effect at the time this case was tried. And it also turns on the opinion of this court in Della Lastra that indicated specifically because the word claimant was not in 41.07, this court determined that you should not combine wrongful death
Mr.
and survival
Etzinger,
damages.
What about 41.001 on the definitions, which starts out in this chapter, claimant means?
Justice Baker, I'm familiar with that language.
Couldn't that lead to an interpretation that across the board under any section in this chapter that we're talking about claimant meaning multiple parties, therefore you can combine actual damages for more than one party to do the cap calculation?
Yes,
even
Your
though
Honor.
It's not stated in there, and even though De La Strada said what it said.
If this court chooses to reverse De La Lastra, then that conclusion could be reached, and I cannot quarrel with that from a standpoint.
Well, the other side says it's a distinguishable case because of the constitutional issue that Justice Hankinson raised in the first place, so it's really off point to some degree. Because you're faced with, as the court said in that case, if you can't go against the Constitution, so surely a statute can't be interpreted to violate a constitutional prohibition.
And Justice Baker, if the court had interpreted in Della Lastra that case the way that the plaintiffs wanted it, it would have done no violence to Article 16, Section 26 for this reason. The parents themselves, while they may have been beneficiaries of the estate, is perhaps a backdoor way for them to recover punitive damages. But as a matter of law, anyone could have been under an estate, a beneficiary of that estate. And so in that case, coincidentally, the parents would have gotten those punitive damages through the probate proceedings or some other way. So we don't believe that that case is distinguishable. When you go back and examine it carefully, I think it says very clearly that the court did not intend to combine wrongful death and survival damages because those had been distinct, separate causes of action. And we believe that the collateral effect of the constitutional issue really is not the controlling point.
So do you believe that a ruling in favor of the respondent would require us overruling De La Lastra?
Yes. I don't see, Justice Abbott, any way that you can avoid that. when you examine the specific holding, and I think that Justice Heck and Enoch and perhaps Chief Justice Phillips had concurred in that, and if my recollection is correct, I think Justice Heck said that he agrees with the court's interpretation of 41.007 and the fact that it does not have in there the claimant language that was presented. Our position on the issue of combining wrongful death and survival damages is pretty straightforward. They're separate and distinct causes of action. They should not be combined. The statute itself does not say that you should combine those particular items. And because of that distinction, they should not be combined. I must move quickly, however, to our second point in the last 2 minutes that I have, and that has to do with the no evidence point. To briefly address the no evidence point, I would just simply say this. When you read the Court of Appeals opinion and analyze it, it gives fairly short shrift to the issues relating to HEA as to negligence and gross negligence. And if this court were to examine carefully the gross negligence conclusions of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, we are confident that the court will say they really didn't specify how it is under Morreale, given the subjective and objective factors that must be considered, how it is under Morreale that there is that evidence that would support an award of punitive damages in this case. That argument and that point relates to HEA only and not Texas Health. And to better understand that, the court needs to understand that Kern Manor was operated by Texas Health. HEA was a management company that provided certain ancillary services to Kern Manor. When you look at the record, it's very clear that it's just mush. Basically, there are references to corporate in there. And there are people who say, well, we made a hotline call. Or there is evidence that says that HEA has some responsibility for looking at charts. But there is no question that Texas Health Enterprises operated that home, hired the people to work there, and that every person employed there was an employee of Texas Health Enterprises.
Well, how about the evidence that someone from a higher location than the local nursing home decided to staff up the nursing home at the time of a state inspection and then staff it down when there was no pending inspection, decided to not provide certain supplies based on an internal budget that had already been met. How can that be? How can those decisions be anybody other than the corporate superstructure?
Justice Phillips, assume that is completely correct, and I'd like to look at the record and confirm that, but assume that what you said is completely correct. What did that have to do with the death of Ruth Simmons? If perhaps on some occasion, at some point in time, there was a staffing irregularity for purposes of a survey that was being done, how is that related to gross negligence and entire want of care, the Morreale standards that are required for this event? You just can't say they were bad people at one point in time and therefore they should be responsible in this case.
The allegation in this case is inadequate staffing at the nursing home is what caused her to not receive the care that she was required to give. I'm afraid I don't understand how you can say that's unconnected.
The allegation was inadequate staffing, and the negligent understaffing was specifically
the question. So if we have a corporate office who is aware that it is understaffed to the point that they staff it up before the state inspectors come so that they can pass the inspection and pull the staff out afterwards because they don't want to do, I'm afraid I'm missing your point and would like for you to explain it further why there's not the causal connection.
In this instance, there was evidence that the administrator and director of nurses were responsible for staffing and hiring and even budgeting. I believe the evidence was that on an occasion when there was a survey, they staffed up and then staffed down after that. Now, if that singular event is sufficient for Ruth Simmons to be able to recover from punitive damage, then the connectedness of punitive damages is one that requires a number of logical leaps.
Wasn't there evidence, though, that HEA was in charge of monitoring the charting for Ms. Simmons?
There is a passing reference that they had some responsibility for monitoring charting. And as a matter of fact, Nurse Lair, the only evidence that is in the record, Nurse Lair, who worked for 5 weeks at the nursing home, said no one from HEA was here during that period of time. And that appears to be the primary evidence on which they hang their hats. But be that as it may,
is it your point, excuse me, Ms. Hutzinger, is it your point that under Morial that there might be a want of care here, but as long as you weren't aware of which person would be injured by the want of care, there's no gross negligence?
No, Justice Ingalls, we would not take it that far. We would not take it to the point of saying that we have to identify the person.
Okay.
But we would say it takes more than just general terms, saying there was a bad survey at this home at one point in time, or at one point in time they staffed up, and then this lady had her leg amputated, had a heart attack 3 days later, went into a coma, and then died 3 days later. And so all of a sudden the management company who had those general responsibilities is responsible for gross negligence under Morial.
Okay, gross again, let me ask you. Staffing up to meet the standards that the state set for operating the home just to pass the test and then making the intentional decision to staff down is no evidence of the first prong, which is the awareness of an extreme risk. That's no evidence of an awareness of an extreme risk, which is an intentional staffing up to pass the standard set by the state for providing care and then staffing down. You're saying it doesn't meet that standard?
Justice Enoch, yes, it could. It could meet that standard if it's just out there. Where is the evidence that says about the time that this event occurred, that they staffed up and staffed down? Where is the evidence that says at this particular time when she was there, there was chronic understaffing and people weren't there? Not just for her, but for anyone.
So that goes to, but that's the second prong, which is of extreme risk of injury. So if the person that was injured wasn't injured at the time that the risk was being undergone, then that's where you say they miss.
Yes.
So if we drive recklessly down the street one time and we don't hurt anybody, but then later on somebody gets injured, there's just no connection between the extreme risk, I mean the extreme awareness here and the actual risk.
Justice Inge, if you drive recklessly down the street and no one is injured, the question then becomes, if someone dies subsequently because for some reason, and they had multiple allegations, if they die for some reason, should that evidence be the evidence, the recklessness in that event, be the evidence that triggers the punitive damages? And I understand your point, and it's well taken, and we're not arguing that you have to, in this instance, say we intended for Ms. Simmons to not have proper care. And so that's the requirement that's placed on the plaintiffs. We're not asking for the court to make that determination.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I please report to Sue Walker with the end arguments for the respondent.
Ms. Walker.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are punitive damages intended to punish the bad conduct of this defendant here?
Yes, Your Honor. This court has repeatedly held on numerous occasions that punitive damages are intended to punish and to deter and not to compensate a specific plaintiff.
Let's assume that your client could have brought separate actions, different lawsuits. Let's just pretend that he could have done that, a wrongful death and a survival action separately. Would he be able to look to the wrongful conduct in a separate suit in order to get punitive damages in a separate suit?
Are you asking me your, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, under your argument, I'm wondering whether or not it leads us to the conclusion that if, in fact, the intent of punitive damages is to punish the bad action of the defendant here, and if you find damages in one suit because of the bad action, why shouldn't you be able to count those damages in a separate suit under your argument?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that issue is before the court in this case, but I would point out that this court has held in a prior case that payment by a defendant of punitive damages in previous cases may be used to mitigate or to show the jury in the existing lawsuit that a great amount of exemplary damages should not be awarded because that defendant has already paid punitive damages for that conduct in other cases. So I think although wrongful death and survival actions are distinct causes of action, I think what the statute looks at, what public policy looks at, what existing case law looks at, and the purpose behind a ratio between punitive damages and actual damages, what all those look at is punishing the core nexus of culpable acts, the core conduct found by the fact finder to constitute gross negligence. And when you're looking at punishing that core conduct, logically, you look to all the damage, all the actual damages caused by that conduct, and all the actual damages are then multiplied by 4.
Well, let's apply that to this case. To clarify Justice Gonzalez's question, let's assume that these two cases have been tried separately, okay? Is it pronounced Geisler or Geisler?
Geisler.
Let's assume Geisler's claim was prosecuted first and no punitive damages were awarded, but there were how much in actual damages?
Your Honor, there was $221,000 of actual damages to the estate and $500,000 of actual damages to Mr. Geisler individually as a wrongful death beneficiary.
And then after Geisler's claim is prosecuted, on the heels of that is the claim of the estate where punitive damages are awarded. Would we be here today? Well, let me not ask it that way. Would you look to the actual damages awarded that are being required to be paid for by Geisler and aggregate those with the actual damages required to be paid?
If, as you say, the purpose is to punish for all the damages caused by the wrongful conduct.
Well, Your Honor, I think that argument could be made. I think that a plaintiff could make that argument and say that I think there would be several hurdles you would have to overcome to make that argument if the cases were not, in fact, tried together, because I think you would have to show that the core nexus of culpable conduct found by the jury was, in fact, the same
Let's say it is.
I think you would have to show that the other problem is that the language of the statute says, 41.007, which we are looking at, says exemplary damages awarded against a defendant may not exceed 4 times the actual damages. So there's a question in my mind.
Is it the actual damages to one suit, or can we consider others?
Exactly. That's the question. And I don't think in this case that issue is before the court, whether the actual damages would be the actual damages in this particular case found by this particular jury. I mean, you would also potentially have a problem that you would have not the same finders of fact making the determination of gross negligence as you found making the determination of actual damages.
But the problem would be application in some other cases. Take, for example, where you have 10 asbestos claims tried together. All the plaintiffs were exposed to the same plant. All plaintiffs got asbestosis. Would you aggregate all the actual damages to determine the application of the cap?
Well, Your Honor, I think that depends, again, on the core conduct. If you have, in my mind, if you have negligent conduct, grossly negligent conduct found by a fact finder that runs individually to individual plaintiffs, then those are separate punitive damages awards, and you would multiply only the actual damages of those particular plaintiffs. And that is, in fact, what the Fort Worth Court of Appeals did in Igotcha versus McGinnis.
Punitives had been awarded on the Geisler claim here, then you wouldn't aggregate the actual
damages. No, you would, because the core culpable conduct, the core facts found by the jury to constitute gross negligence are the same for Geisler and for the estate. There are no independent acts of gross negligence running from THE or HEA to Geisler individually. Therefore, the conduct that we're trying to punish and deter is one core set of facts, and it encompasses just that core set of facts, so there's no independent acts of negligence running from THE and HEA to Mr. Geisler. So the actual damages, the total harm caused by that culpable conduct to Ruth Simmons, and as a result, to her wrongful death beneficiary are combined to form the actual damages.
I don't understand why that analysis would not apply to an asbestos claim or any mass tort claim.
It could apply, Your Honor, if the core culpable conduct is the same. For example, in Igotcha versus McGinnis, in that case, a single defendant negligently served alcohol to two minors. One of the minors left the bar together and were killed in a car wreck. The minor who was killed, parents brought wrongful death cause of action. The minor who survived brought his own negligence cause of action against the bar. Because the conduct of the defendant, the grossly negligent conduct, was different as to the deceased minor, I mean, he may have been very intoxicated and the bar negligently continued to serve him, grossly negligently continued to serve him when he was very intoxicated, versus their conduct towards the other minor who was just injured. Because those are two different sets of culpable conduct, because of that, there were two punitive damages award. One punitive damages award went to the estate of the deceased minor, and one punitive damages award went to the minor who survived, who brought his negligent cause of action. So, though in that situation, the court did not combine those two plaintiffs' actual damages and multiply them by four to get the cap. They combined the actual damages caused by that particular culpable conduct of the defendant. So the wrongful death beneficiary's damages were combined and multiplied by four to reach the cap as to the punitive damages awarded to the decedent.
Ms. Walker, at bottom we have a statutory interpretation question here, and we're not riding on a clean slate because, as Mr. Etzinger has pointed out, we decided De La Strada several years ago. Why doesn't our disposition of that case and the holding in that case control the way we interpret the statute here and lead to the result that Mr. Etzinger is urging us to reach?
Well, Your Honor, I very much disagree with Mr. Etzinger's contention that De La Lastra would have to be overruled. De La Lastra, in that situation, this court, the key to that case, this court wrote, it is well established that this provision, the constitutional provision, defines the class of persons who are entitled to wrongful death damages, punitive damages. Parents of the deceased, while they are entitled to maintain an action under the wrongful death statute, are included in Article 16, Section 26, and are therefore unable to recover punitive damages. That is the key to the whole case. This court specifically held that because parents are excluded from the constitutional provision allowing recovery of punitive damages in wrongful death cases, they could not recover those damages.
What difference does it make if the law excludes it or the jury found that they shouldn't get it?
Well, Your Honor, what the jury did was the jury did not award punitive damages to Ray Geisler, and we're not contending that under the jury charge that was erroneous. What we're contending is that Ray Geisler's actual damages were caused, the total actual damages caused by the defendant's culpable conduct included Ray Geisler's actual damages. Therefore, Ray Geisler's actual damages are multiplied by four to compute the cap.
But in De La Lastra, you couldn't, that one claimant could not get punitive damages because the law wouldn't allow it. In this case, one claimant is not going to get punitive damages because the jury wouldn't allow it. What's the difference?
Well, Your Honor, the jury was aware of the fact that Mr. Geisler was a wrongful death beneficiary. The jury was also aware of the fact, and it was on the record, that Mr. Geisler's brother was a wrongful death beneficiary, and that they were bringing this suit on behalf of the estate of Ruth Simmons. So I think to say that the jury was unaware that this would pass through to Mr. Geisler would not be accurate. That evidence was before the jury, and the only reason that two blanks were put there was so that the jury could apportion the money between Mr. Geisler as individually as a wrongful death beneficiary and the estate.
Just as an aside, how does that make sense if the function of punitive damages is to punish? How does the apportionment? That sounds more compensatory.
Well, Your Honor, the law requires that the jury apportion punitive damages between all the parties seeking punitive damages. typically what would happen is the jury charge would ask for an amount, as Justice Hankinson pointed out, would ask for an amount of money, and then the next question following would say, as between these plaintiffs, how do you allocate the punitive damages? In this case, those two questions were combined, and if you look at the charge in section questions 6 and 7, the Moriel factors are listed, and then it says what amount of money, if any, and then it lists the two individuals, Walter Geisler individually and the estate, who are, in this case, making claims for punitive damages. So those two questions were just combined into one question.
I want to go back to your hypothetical about the difference between this and the I Got You versus McGinnis case. It seems to me that a survival cause of action and a wrongful death cause of action can be for quite different things. And in conduct which led to a death, if the conduct causes a long drawn out death with a lot of suffering, the survival cause of action can be quite different from a case where it's immediate. And the difference between the wrongful death beneficiary, whose compensation is for this person no longer being alive, and the estate, whose compensation is for suffering before death, could be much more different than the distinction between how much alcohol two young people were served at the same time sitting together in a bar. So I didn't understand your distinction between those cases.
Well, Your Honor, I think that, again, then we're focusing on the damages suffered by a particular plaintiff or in a particular cause of action, and that is not the focus. The focus is on the culpable conduct of the defendant.
But isn't that what the court did in De La Lastra? There's language repeatedly in that opinion that talks about the distinction, as Chief Justice Phillips points out, between the wrongful death claim and the survival action and the damages that are awarded for each. I mean, isn't that the whole point behind De La Lastra?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I believe that the whole point behind De La Lastra is that this court is going to uphold the Constitution when it does not include parents as persons who are entitled to recover punitive damages in wrongful death cases. I think that that is the bottom line holding of De La Lastra. Concerning Justice Phillips' question, it is the culpable conduct of the defendant that is being punished. The total damages that causes are added together and multiplied by 4.
But that conduct can be quite different in certain circumstances for these two different causes of action.
Well, if there is different conduct and it is established to the jury that there's different conduct, then there would be two punitive damages awarded.
So we've got to come up to the Supreme Court of Texas in each situation like this and let us review the evidence to see if basically there's one set of conduct for both causes of action or two sets of conduct.
Well, Your Honor,
and then once we decide that, you can decide the multiplier number.
In this case, there is no direct contact. There is no direct action between Walter Geisler and THE and HEA. They did nothing directly to be grossly negligent to him. Their gross negligence flows through Ruth Simmons, and I believe that is the way it works in 99% of the wrongful death and survival cases.
But their gross negligence causes a quick death versus a prolonged death, that's going to be quite different, result in quite different types of damage for these two causes of action.
But again, you're focusing on the damages of the plaintiff or the survival damages and the wrongful death damages instead of focusing on the culpable conduct, the nucleus of conduct found by the finder of fact
but there
to
can
constitute
be more than
gross
one,
negligence.
It, particularly in the case of a nursing home, where somebody goes in and they come out prematurely dead, I mean, there's more than one instance of conduct that is typically alleged. There are various instances. I mean, there's different things, and that's what you've alleged. There's a lot of different conduct by different entities at different times, and some of that may affect these two causes of action quite differently. But be that as it may, would you spend a few of your remaining minutes answering the contention that your allegations of gross negligence go principally to the nursing home on site and not to the management, and how do you tie the management's alleged gross negligence into this particular death?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, I think there were several comments here of how far do we take this. How far we take it is a scintilla. And as long as there is a scintilla of evidence in this record to support the jury's finding, then there is legally sufficient evidence. And the record shows, Your Honor, that HEA managed this nursing home. Richard Knight, the president of HEA, testified on Volume 6, page 198, that HEA was to provide all these support services that include financial, purchasing, major physical plant repair, nurse consulting, personnel functions to the extent that it's predominantly hiring and licensure. That is the president of HEA giving that testimony. Then when you look at the record and you see a total absence of those functions being performed at this nursing home, Justice Baker in Mobile Oil Company versus Elander recognized that omissions, that corporate omissions, can constitute the basis for gross negligence.
Did HEA do the hiring and the firing?
Your Honor, that right there constitutes the testimony that I've recited. That constitutes a scintilla of evidence that HEA did do the hiring and firing.
What was the evidence? Did they do the hiring and the firing or not?
Your Honor, there is conflicting testimony on that point. And viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the jury verdict and disregarding all contrary evidence, it's our position that the evidence is sufficient.
Precisely where and what was the evidence that they did the hiring and the firing?
Your Honor, it comes right here from Mr. Knight, who's the president of HEA, on Volume 6, page 198, that says that HEA provides personnel functions to the extent that it's predominantly hiring and licensure. Additionally, HEA employed RN nurse consultants and regional consultants to monitor quality assurance, monitor resident care and treatment, ensure proper charting and staffing at the THE-owned nursing homes. And that's on Volume 6, page 198 through 202, also of the president of HEA's testimony on those pages. The HEA's RN nurse consultants were responsible for ensuring proper resolution of all state-cited deficiencies. And that's Volume 6 of the record, page 201.
What was the evidence about the status of staffing at the time that the negligence occurred? Was it understaffed or not?
Yes, Your Honor. At the time that this act occurred, the nursing home's license had been revoked. The state, it was so bad that the state had revoked the nursing home's license.
That's where I was a little confused. I thought your opposition said that they had restaffed up to try to get their license back. And my question was, what was the status of staffing at the time the negligence occurred?
Your Honor, it's my understanding, based on the record, that at the time this negligence occurred, this nursing home was not licensed and had not cured the state deficiencies concerning staffing. I think that the record references to that are set forth in the independent ground that we presented, that HEA and THE were not licensed, and that because this court decided the all decision, you don't have to reach that issue in this case, and that was an independent ground that we raised to say that 4590I did not cap the punitive damages against HEA in this case or against THE because they were not a licensed facility, and 4590I requires a nursing home to be licensed in order to come within the definition of 4590I health care provider. So those record references are in our brief under that independent ground.
Let me ask a question. Isn't it possible that there might be a core conduct that occurred, but the jury just determined that as to one of the parties, it was deserving of punishment, but as to one of the other parties, it was not deserving of punishment? Couldn't a zero finding of punitive damages for Mr. Geisler be a decision that for that conduct there shouldn't be punishment? Assuming that this is just punishment and not compensation, isn't that some sort of consideration about what the amount of the punitives ought to be capped at?
Your Honor, in this case, the conduct is the same. To say that the jury didn't award any punitive damages to Geisler because there's no conduct running to him, that the conduct goes through Ruth Simmons. The conduct is THE and HEA's grossly negligent conduct towards Ruth Simmons. As a result of that conduct, because his mother died, because his mother suffered, because he suffered emotional distress damages, Walter Geisler was damaged. Those damages that Walter Geisler suffered were caused by THE and HEA's grossly negligent conduct as found by the finder of fact. So the conduct of THE and HEA is the same for Ruth Simmons as it is for Walter Geisler. Therefore, the total damages that that conduct caused are added together and multiplied by four under the cap. In situations where there are separate nucleuses, if you want to call it that, of culpable conduct on behalf of a defendant running to different plaintiffs, as in I Gotcha and as in the Seminole Pipeline case, then in those cases, the actual damages caused by that culpable conduct of the defendant are added together and multiplied by four. It doesn't necessarily include all the actual damages of all the plaintiffs.
So it's possible that the person that was the object of the evil motive or gross negligent conduct would suffer little damage, but a derivative claimant, loss of consortium or something, might suffer great damage.
Yes.
And therefore, the punitives that would be awarded would be based on essentially four times the larger amount of damages, even though the jury determined that there was pretty nominal damages to the person the focus of this bad conduct was. And in your scenario, then you would add all those damages together to figure out the cap, even though the person who was the object of the conduct suffered very little damage as a result of it.
Yes, Your Honor. If a car went down the street and hit somebody and killed them instantly and they suffered very little damages, no medical expenses, no pain and suffering, attributable to that nucleus of culpable conduct are added together and multiplied by four to reach Section 41.007's four times actual damages cap.
If the jury thought that the culpable conduct was directed at the events that led to the suffering of the patient before her death rather than to the cause of death or afterward, couldn't they use that division in culpable conduct to make one award for the survivor claim and one award for the wrongful death? You say no.
Your Honor, Walter Geisler's damages are actual damages caused by the culpable conduct of the defendant. Therefore, to punish and deter that culpable conduct, all of the actual damages are added together and multiplied by four. And it's our position that if this is a jury charge case, if this case pivots on how it was submitted to the jury, then that issue's been waived. There was no objection to the charge. There was no, that issue has never been raised. So if this court is going to make the case a jury charge issue case, then we win for sure.
But the petitioner wants to stand on the charge. He wants to say that the division makes sense. I mean, that's part of their argument.
Well, Your Honor, as a matter of law,
in fact, they concede, as I heard them earlier, that if there'd just been one line, this would be a totally different case.
Your Honor, as a matter of law, I don't think there can be two punitive damages awards stemming from one nucleus of culpable conduct. And that's our position, that in this case there was one punitive damages award that, instead of submitting two separate questions asking for the dollar amount of the blank, the dollar amount blank, and then followed by a give percentages, and it makes no sense to me that if the jury had awarded 0%, that then Mr. Utzinger's happy with the charge, but because the jury awarded $0, now somehow that interjects reversible error in the case. That makes no sense to me. Your Honor, for all these reasons,
I have a question on what you were just talking about. Does the statutory scheme that the legislature put in effect require an apportionment of punitives? Is that why cases are submitted that way?
Your Honor, cases are submitted that way because of the pattern jury charge. And the pattern jury charge, section 10.3 in the 1998 version of the general negligence pattern jury charge, gives the general punitive damages dollar amount question, listing the Moriel factors, and then it's followed by, or also 9.7, which gives the percentages between the punitive damages claimants or the person seeking punitive damages, and that's also reflected in PJC 81.6 and PJC 81.7 in the 1998 version of the medical malpractice products and premises cases.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Etzinger, let me ask you the question that I asked Ms. Walker. You have wrongful death and survivorship based on a car wreck, and clearly meet the Moriel standard for gross negligence, instantaneous death. So there are going to be some damages, but not the medical and not the pain and suffering. But you've got tremendous loss for the family, and so the family members. And suppose you submit it as this way, too, for punitive damages, and the jury says, well, the conduct was as to her, punitive damages, smaller regular damages, actual damages. And then as to all the wrongful beneficiaries, well, we've already given big punitive damages to the person who suffered, and it goes to the estate anyway, so we've punished them. We've now punished them. We've given them a significant punishment, and now we just give actual damages to the rest of the estate. And so you end up with nominal damages for the one that the focus was on and large damages for the other, and you make the argument you can't combine, so they're limited to just four times what they awarded this person. Is that what the statute intended?
Justice Enoch, we believe that it did. We believe that you cannot combine wrongful death and survival causes of action. Those have been separate forever.
And so the punishment, so the wrongdoer actually escapes punishment assessed based on the damages they caused.
I believe in Drill X, this court talked about, it just can't help it if that's the result. When it dealt with how you divide under the Comparative Responsibility Act, the effect of a settlement credit. And sometimes that happens. The problem this court is faced with is one that is very, very difficult to grasp, because on one hand, we're faced with the concept of punishing. We recognize that's the purpose of punitive damages, and it's to punish the wrongdoer. On the other hand, we're faced with a concept that's deeply ingrained in Texas law that says these are two distinct causes of action. They can have different types of damages. They can have different types of gross sort of damages that the people suffer, or actual damages that the people suffer from.
But even though they're two separate actions, they're both derivative, and they arise out of one person's injuries and death. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
So the other side argues that there's a nexus of conduct that caused the injuries that are divided by virtue of the statutory schemes that the legislature passed when they're under common law. There was no right of recovery. So even though if they're two separate actions, does that lead to the conclusion that you can't combine them under this 4100 statutory scheme on how you calculate punitive damages?
We believe that you should not, Your Honor, and that is primarily...
But what's the basis of why you believe that?
Well, one reason is because this is what this court said.
I know you keep saying they're separate causes of action, but how does the syllogism work to get to your conclusion?
Your Honor, and that's the difficulty with punitive damages. I'm not trying to dodge your question, but let me put it in these terms. For some reason, there has been a decision made of applying a cap under these circumstances, a four times cap. It's not our decision. It was the legislature's decision to say that is a reasonable relationship. The relationship between actual damages and punitive damages should be four times.
Mm-hmm.
That's the legislative theory, and that's why you look at the actual damages, we believe, of the individual who suffered them. Now, Justice O'Neill...
But the statute does not include language, actual damages suffered by the particular individual. I mean, isn't that the piece that's missing from the statute that
causes you difficulty in asking us to interpret the statute that way?
Yes, Justice Hankinson, either way.
We have to engraft that language on in order to get to that point.
That's what this court must do.
And your view is that De La Strada, we already did that.
Right, and said, no, it doesn't. That's exactly right. In the 38 seconds I have left, I just want to address that waiver question because we did not I didn't try the case, but trial counsel did not waive any jury objections for two reasons. Number one, if the court had properly applied the caps, the four times caps, as we thought that it would have, then there would have been no error in the way the case was submitted. But secondly, and I don't want to bring this issue up and have y'all talk to me a lot about it because I don't want to talk about this right now, is the 4590i caps. At that point in time, the belief of trial counsel was that that set an absolute cap of $1.3 million on actual and punitive damages. So as the law was at that point in time, there was no reason to object. For these reasons, we'd ask the court to reverse the trial court as to Texas Health Enterprise, as to HEA, and in addition to that, find that Ms. Geisler's damages are the only ones that should be considered. I mean, Ms. Simmons' damages should be the only ones considered to apply the
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will now take a brief recess.
Please rise.